Why he was appointed. I think he asked him to do something else, didn't he? Which he wouldn't do, and asked him, I don't know why. Or he thought they'd like Gavin because of...
General.
Yeah, he thought they'd like him because of the war.
Mm-hmm.
But then I know he was rather disappointed when Gavin's cables would come back. Jack used to quote Winston Churchill, never trust the man on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that he'd go and so, and I remember Malraux saying about him, oh yes, Gavin, il est gaulliste. And you know something else nice that Jack did? This is the same sort of thing that he did about Alan Dulles and the Reitzmans. When the Mona Lisa came over here, Gavin was no longer ambassador. He'd had to resign for money reasons. And we, the Alphonse came for dinner one night. We were discussing who they would have at the French embassy in the Mona Lisa dinner. And Jack said she was really, she could only have 102, and I think she was up to 99 or something. Jack put Dick Goodwin on the list because he wanted to show how much he thought of him. But also he said, but you don't have the Gavins here. And Nicole said, no, no, why should we have the Gavins? And Jack said, well, I think you better ask them. And when they'd gone home, Jack said, can you believe it? Is it the French or power or what? But there was Gavin, who was the most pro de Gaulle ambassador they ever had. You know, they're probably one of our ambassadors that they liked the best.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's out there, when he can ask him to the dinner, he was disgusted.
As you say, ruthless.
Instead of running out.
How did he like Hervé?
Oh, old Hervé, you know, he'd get amused by him sometimes, and then amused and sort of irritated the way, you know, Hervé has that phobia about protocol.
Mm-hmm.
But then, as you always said, de Gaulle never spoke to Hervé.
Mm-hmm.
It was very hard for Hervé, and every time we'd see David Gore or Caroline would go to play with Alice Ormsby Gore, I mean, you'd hear Hervé moaning all around Washington. But he enjoyed, Hervé could be funny sometimes.
Very good mimic.
Yeah, do you remember the toast he made at that party for Ken Galbraith about a Gemini, that he was a Gemini and Jack, it was just after Jack's birthday, and Jack was a Gemini. And he wished a toast, or Gemini men were virile, brilliant, kind. It was terribly funny, and he wished to congratulate his government on having chosen him as a Gemini to be ambassador to a Gemini president. And then he ended, Vive Lafayette. It was just a whole party. I always used to tease him so about Lafayette. So he was all right.
The Sixth Conversation, Tuesday, June 2nd, 1964.
We left off last time after the meeting at Vienna, when Khrushchev brought up the whole Berlin thing in a very tough way. You remember the president said to him, it looks as if it's going to be a long, cold winter. The whole Berlin business, of course, involved constant relations with the Germans. What was the president's feeling about these dealings with West Germany?
As I said before, he tried so hard not to bring problems that irritated him all day home. You know, for himself, really, more than me. But that was one thing that he, you know, that just irritated him so. And he'd say, what do you have to do to show the Germans that you care? You know, and that we would defend Berlin, and then it would always, you know, it just seemed the least tiny thing could happen. Some colonel drop his hat on the Autobahn, and it would give, Adenauer would start flaming up all over again, and saying that we were going to pull out, and the ambassador here, Greve, would come running in. And Jack really got irritated with the Germans, and I remember after the missile crisis, which is much later, he got so irritated with de Gaulle, because what did de Gaulle say, that because we jumped in to take care of Cuba, it showed we only were interested in the things near our shores and not over there. Well, when you think of it, it wasn't until after his visit to Berlin in June 63 that he finally did convince them,
You know, and then he was really happy after that. But, and then there were all these leaks to the press. The Germans were always doing that, leaking to the press, both in Germany and in Washington, little things of lack of confidence in us. So I'd say, you know, Adenauer, sometimes he'd say about him, we really, I guess he sort of admired Adenauer, but he said, look at that man, 89, just hanging on so hard. I forget when Adenauer left, but he said, can you imagine it, and trying desperately to get back in again. And, you know, Adenauer really gave him a pain. But I can remember the Berlin crisis just sort of coming all through that, I guess, was it this?
It was constant, really, from this middle of summer of 1962.
So it was really a year after Vienna that it finally came and he made a speech?
Yeah, no, I mean from the summer of 1961. It began in the summer of Vienna. And it went from there until the Cuban crisis, really, in November 62.
Well, when did he make his speech?
He made his speech in June 1961, after he got back from Vienna. He made the speech calling for an enlargement of the military, of the defense budget.
But is that when he said, we do not like to fight, but we have fought before, mm-hmm. and they said that Stalingrad was untenable, and
I don't remember.
Free men have always fought, and they said Stalingrad was untenable, and this and that, and we do not like to fight, but we have fought before. Well, anyway, I could just remember, you know, one of the few times, I always thought with Jack that anything he could make, you know, once he was in control, anything, all the best things would happen. In this childish way, I thought I won't have to be afraid when I go to sleep at night or wake up. But you could see after that Khrushchev meeting, I mean, he was really in a gloom, which he wouldn't talk about, but you could just tell by the sort of a certain quietness and loneliness. So I thought, I remember a couple of times just a little shooting pain of fright going through me, thinking, you know, cannot even Jack make this turn out for the best? And so this mounting thing, and then when he was going to go on television to speak of Berlin, all the tension and everything around the White House, and I can remember again him marching, scribbling on the pages, and, you know, for a few days before, and maybe he'd read me a line or something, but, and then I can remember that day looking out my dressing room window, looked on the Rose Garden in his office and all the television cables, and I remember thinking, shall I go over in his office and watch it? But then I thought, no, that might make him more nervous or people would start taking pictures or something. I better just watch it up here.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, that was one of the grimmest speeches I've ever seen him make.
Mm-hmm. It was probably the grimmest speech he gave.
Yeah, and you just couldn't believe that you were sitting there thinking that you really might have to go to war. And then,
grim speech, except, of course, for the Cuba Missile speech.
But that was sort of the first one, so it almost frightened me more, because by the time of the missile crisis, of course, you were scared all through it, but, you know, the Berlin was the first one, and then it did turn out all right. So, that's what I remember about that.
Yes, Berlin was really the big thing in the summer and fall of 61. And then, as a result of our reaction, remember, Khrushchev then extended the deadline. So
that's right.
In I believe, November.
And then I remember thinking a couple of times how true it was. Something rather interesting about Jack, that he had, by nature and in politics, I used to see it, this conciliatory nature, which never meant that you sort of sucked around people or, you know, tried to curry favor, but what did he say? In politics, you don't have friends or something. Is it you have colleagues or...
Interests, was it?
No, it's that you don't have friends or allies. You have colleagues. Well, you can look it up. But, I mean, I often used to say to him, you know, some man would come to dinner, a newspaper man or a politician, and I'd say, but, you know, you were so nice to him, or you're speaking nicely about him. And I was so mad about him for what he wrote 2 weeks ago or said 2 weeks ago that I'd been cutting that man dead all day. And now I meant to be nice to him, and Jack would say, of course, you know, that's all over. And then he did this and that. So, you know, his relationships always change, and he never made it hard for anyone to come back and be forgiven or, you know, go on in a new relationship with him, which was so true in marriage, too. It just carried into every phase. And I remember thinking, isn't it, thank God he has that side and not that old funny Della side where nobody, you know, where you'd have to make people grovel so. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking of the inaugural address, let's never negotiate a fear. Because I thought how humiliating really for Khrushchev to have to back down.
Mm-hmm.
And yet somehow Jack let him do it with grace and didn't rub his nose in it. And somehow that was the quality which we should all be the most grateful for. It's how we got through all these crises.
Yes, it was a marvelous thing. To leave a way for your opponent to retreat and preserve his dignity.
Yeah. And if you wanted lots of popularity in the newspapers or something, you'd go around shouting things about no one's going to tell him, say this to America, and then you'd just be, you know, everybody'd be shooting before you knew it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that side of him which... it was always so easy when you were married. I mean, a little tiny thing might come up that would cloud. You never really had a fight, but I might say something that would sort of hurt his feelings, and there'd be a certain quietness that day. And then suddenly I'd come running and say, oh, I'm so sorry, and throw my arms around him, and he'd just laugh, and everything was over. He never would hold, you know, or make you really... That just ran all through his personality. And... you know, Bobby's getting it, and it was a side of Bobby that's lacking a bit, which he's developing much more now, and which since November he's spoken to me so much about Jack, the side that he admired in him so much. It was really easier for Jack to be that way when he had Bobby doing a lot of the things, but it was also much more part of his personality.
Mm-hmm.
Bobby would get that way.
As the Berlin thing was dying down in November, Nehru came, and
yes, and well, that was a rather nerve-wracking visit. Lots of consultations with Galbraith and everything, and Galbraith kept saying he wanted to, Nehru wanted no fuss and everything private. And I remember Jack had shown me a memorandum the winter before about maybe was it Sihanouk of Cambodia?
Prince Sihanouk.
Well, anyway, from the State Department, it was saying this man will say that he wants nothing special, no treatment, but yet he'll be furious if you don't lay the red carpet out and sort of have throngs.
Mm-hmm.
So Jack sort of was wondering whether Galbraith's advice was quite right, because he thought Nehru would like a lot more pomp, but no, Galbraith thought he just wanted to be received in our home. Well, Hyannis just seemed a little too depressing, mm-hmm. So we went to Newport. We met him at whatever that Air Force base is there. He came over with his daughter and Galbraith and the Indian ambassador, B.K. Nehru. And Jack had a most unsatisfactory time with Nehru when he'd been a congressman in India. He said they'd warned him, whenever Nehru gets bored with you, he taps his fingertips together and looks up at the ceiling. And Jack said he'd been there about 10 minutes when Nehru started to look up at the ceiling.
when had they met? I hadn't realized they'd met before.
Well, Jack had toured the Far East.
This was in 51?
With Bobby and Pat. It was before we were married.
Yeah, 50 or 51.
It was when he met General De Lattre, who was so mm-hmm. impressed with it. It's when he nearly died in Okinawa. If Bobby hadn't come in, he would have died then. He got a fever of 105 or 6. And he met Nehru on that trip, I think. Mm-hmm. So, anyway, they came and it was decided the men would eat in the dining room. Angie Duke was there too, and Mrs. Gandhi and I would have a little ladies' lunch in the living room, and Lynn Billings was with us. Well, of course, she hated that, and she liked to be in with the men, and she is a real prune, bitter, kind of pushy, horrible woman. You know, I just don't like her a bit. It always looks like she's been sucking a lemon. But anyway, Lem. But before lunch... And Jack brought Nehru back on the honey fits. And Caroline and I were waiting for him at the front door. She picked a little flower for him and made a curtsy. That's the first time he sort of smiled. And then we went and had a drink before lunch, and Nehru never said one word. It was just such heavy going. You could ask him something, anything. Just that real Hindu thing. You learn it in India, that they don't look on social gatherings as a time to speak. I don't know if they're contemplating what. But I'd also say it's just damn spoiled brattishness, because you should make an effort when other people are trying. So anyway, they had their lunch, and I don't know what they talked about. And then we all went back in the helicopter. Caroline, Nehru in the best seat, Caroline on Jack's lap next to him, back to Washington. And that night they came for dinner. And I think it was when... It was the first dinner of that fall in the White House. And we lit the fire in the Oval Room and then went downstairs to meet them at the front door. And, of course, somebody hadn't opened the flue of the fireplace. So when we came back in that room, the smoke was just so thick and everyone's eyes were pouring. That wasn't a very good start. And it was meant to be, as you remember, a rather small dinner, but yet it wasn't quite small enough or big enough, because we were in the state dining room. And just enough of us, so it was rather like sitting in a church with not enough people there. And I remember Jack told me later that Mrs. Gandhi, all through dinner, really lit out at Jack on our policy somewhere and this and that, and said lots of nice things about Krishna Menon and everything. And, you know, Jack really didn't like her. My sister was there, and I so badly wanted her to sit next to Nehru, who sort of should have sat next to Lady Bird. And I said, what shall I do? And Jack said, call up Lady Bird before, because she might expect to go there, and ask her if it's all right, which I did, and she was sweet and, you know, understood. Which just shows one more thoughtfulness that Jack always had for his vice president. Well, Nehru does sort of like pretty women in the most unlecherous way, but it's just the only... You know, he sort of talked between Lee and I, and you could get him to say something about something and make a little joke. So he was rather nice then. And I think he asked us to come to India. I think that's when he did it. That's when the whole idea started. And, what's the part I remember? Oh, he always took, there's a picture of him with my, taking my arm.
Yes, yes.
Well, we got sort of, I guess, to be a little bit friends in Newport, and then the helicopter and the plane. And, you know, he takes your arm. I mean, he was sort of sweet to me, and they did bring the most touching, thoughtful presents for the children, and in little boxes, little costumes, nothing very fabulous. So they'd obviously cared about the trip and had this chip on their shoulder. I don't know. We tried to be so nice to them. And the next night, there was a big dinner at the Indian Embassy. And again, I sat next to Nehru. I found him very easy and charming, you know. And he seemed to so like to have someone make it. You know, I always felt that he liked me, but I just think it was really sticky going in the conferences.
What did the president? Did the president say anything afterwards? Was he disappointed in Nehru?
I think he was. I mean, I think the meetings got absolutely nowhere, and there was an awful lot of tapping the fingers and looking up at the ceiling, and... You know, Nehru's like trying... Did Jack say that about Nehru or someone else? It's like trying to grab in your hand something and it turns out to just be fog. Mm-hmm. That's what it was like. And I think Nehru... In a way, he was... Would you say jealous of Jack or something? Well, it was just someone so different than...
Well, I think the generational thing played its part here. I think I'm sure he was infinitely pleased that a man like... Jack Kennedy was president of the United States, but on the other hand, a young, brilliant man half his age was bound to make him feel uncomfortable.
And then Mrs. Gandhi, his daughter, who's one of those women who, when marriage and love and all those things don't turn out right, it's as if it all goes back inside you and the poison works inside like an ulcer. So she's a truly bitter woman, and she's the kind of woman who's always hated Jack. You can name so many violently liberal women in politics who were always suspicious of Jack.
Mm-hmm.
I wish that one, and they always loved Adelaide. And I thought one reason, this is just my own sort of psychology, but that Jack so obviously demanded from a woman a relationship between a man and a woman, where a man would be the leader and a woman would be his wife, look up to him as a man. With Adelaide, you could have another relationship where, he'd sort of be sweet and you could talk, but you wouldn't ever come down to a definite thing. I always thought women who were scared of sex loved Adelaide. Because there would never be
the challenge.
Yeah, not that there'd be the challenge with Jack, but it was a different kind
mm-hmm.
of man.
Mm-hmm.
So, all these sort of twisted, the poor little women whose lives hadn't worked out could find a bomb in Adelaide.
Mm-hmm.
And Jack made them nervous.
Yeah.
Which I used to tell, Jack would say, why doesn't so-and-so, And I'd say, Jack, it's the greatest compliment to you. I know it's true. He didn't quite see it. He said that about your wife, as a matter of fact.
Oh, really?
I said, he was very upset when you came out for him. Then a day or so later, Marion came out for Adelaide Stevenson, and he couldn't understand why. Because I think you'd just been down to lunch the day or so before, or a week before, and had a very nice
mm-hmm.
time. And he liked Marion and everything. Well, I said, Jack, it's because Arthur's so mean to her. And Adelaide was so nice. I saw them together later, I said, that's different. That's her own personal problem. That's got nothing to do with you. You mustn't hold it against Marion. And then later on, when we were all in the White House together, then he, loved her and saw that she didn't really dislike him.
Oh, no, Marion, I may say, lived to regret that. I got remember a funny letter from Bobby after that. Something, he was writing about something else, and he had a postscript to the effect, I see you can't control your wife any better than I can control mine. That was an act of old loyalty on Marion's part.
Yeah.
She thought I shouldn't,
But I mean, in my marriage, I could never conceive. And I remember I said it in an interview once, and all these women, we got all these irate letters. Someone said, where do you get your opinions? And I said, I get all my opinions from my husband, which is true. How could I have any political opinions? His were going to be the best. And I could never conceive of not voting for whoever my husband was for. Anyone who I'd be married to, I suppose if I was married to. So that was just so strange, because that was, it was really rather terribly Victorian or Asiatic relationship, which we had, which I
think. The Japanese wife.
Yeah, which I think is the best. But anyway, we got off that. That was Mrs. Gandy.
She was a rancorous woman, and spiteful. I mean, she exuded spite. Was Nehru different on his home ground?
He was terribly sweet again to Lee and I. And he would come home every afternoon and take us for walks in the garden. We'd feed the pandas. And I think what he liked, one of his sisters, Mrs. Hootie Singh, I guess she's the rather right-wing one who lives in Bombay, but she's great fun. She said to me, she'd come and lay in my room and talk, and she said, it's so good for my brother to have you two girls here at some relaxation, because she says his daughter fills the poor man's life with politics. It's politics at lunch, politics at tea, politics at dinner. He never has any relaxation. So that visit, nothing profound was talked about, or even that we were going to Pakistan next, but it was a relaxation for him, the kind of thing I tried to bring into Jack's life in our evenings at home. Someone who wasn't connected with what was worrying him all day.
Mm-hmm.
And so he just loved that trip, and we got to be, he used to walk me back to my bedroom every night, two nights I think we were there, and sit in there for about an hour and talk to me.
And he'd be lively, he wouldn't have this kind of vacant, passive
Well, he's never lively, but sort of gentle, and he would talk, and he has those great brown eyes, and I'd read all his autobiography, and I'd asked him about some of those, you know, times, and he talked.
What would he talk about his own past? And
well, I asked him about the times in prison and everything, and, you know, his life, and yeah, he'd talk about some of that. The rest he'd talk about people there, or, you know, make a little joke. He always was so... I've written it all down somewhere, everything we talked about, so maybe I can find it. It's the only thing I ever wrote down.
Oh, good. No, let's find that. And the library should have a copy. The other big thing that happened in the fall of 61, or another one, was the resumption of nuclear testing by the Soviet Union. And then, which confronted us with the problem of whether we should resume nuclear testing or not. That was an old interest of the president's, was it?
Yes. I can remember him being so worried at the time about our resuming, you know, and how long you should, you could possibly put it off, and then everyone, I mean, that was a terrible time for him. But it's so interesting because there was nothing that worried him more through, would be 61 and 2, than all this testing. Mm-hmm. But it started so long ago, because I can remember when David Gore came to Hyannis, the fall we were married would be October or November 1953, and he was doing something at the UN on disarmament. And he and Jack were talking, you know, and it was the first time I'd ever heard. It seemed so extraordinary. You never saw it in newspapers here, that you should sort of disarm or come to some agreement, and then that would be possible without selling out. Or, you know, when you always thought all the Bertrand Russells and Ban the Bombers and people were all sort of pinks. I mean, I just thought this from reading David Lawrence in the newspapers. And I remember then, from then on, Jack started to say in his speeches, or it could have been later, but he said that it was a disgrace that there were less than 100 people working on disarmament in Washington, or less than 10 maybe.
Less than 100.
But he said that in all, and I think he said it all through his Senate campaign. Mm-hmm. He certainly said it all through his campaign for the presidency. You know, but it started so long ago that he was thinking about that. And in a way, then David Gore came back again in maybe 58 or, yes, or 57, I don't know what year. He and Sissy came to the Cape. Again, they'd be talking about that. And I remember when Harold Macmillan resigned last summer. Well, Jack was so sad for that man that he should have to go out in all the messy, sad way he did. You know, and he said people really, you know, don't realize what Macmillan has done. And he said he was the greatest friend of the Atlantic Alliance. But he said this nuclear disarmament thing, you know, he just cared about that for so long. So that's what I tried. And then he sent him this touching telegram, and I remember it, you know, poor Macmillan, and not many people were saying nice things to him. And David asked if the telegram could be made public, and Jack said of course. And that's what I tried to put in when I talked to him on Telstar just last week, on Jack's what would have been his 47th birthday. You know, the things that I knew that Jack thought about him, and I found that telegram and read it and tried to say what Jack had said about him, and, you know. And I kept thinking, I just hope De Gaulle's listening, not that anything matters now.
I have the impression that we would not have had a test ban treaty if both the president and the prime minister had not been so deeply committed and forced the issue so constantly on their advisors.
I know. I know that's true, and I also think having David Gore here at the time made it
indispensable, yes.
And I can remember, yeah, sometimes, well, we can go into that relationship at another time, but so many things happened. He would come for dinner and or something awful would be going wrong in British Guiana or somewhere, and he would put, or the time of Skybold he was with us, mm-hmm. and he would call, and, you know, everything would be kept smooth. But what I just wanted to say about, I was thinking when I thought of Jack and Macmillan really making this test ban thing possible, of just how outrageous of De Gaulle, of the one thing that really matters, and that egomaniac, not to be associated with that when that's going to be the one thing that matters in this whole century. And Graham Sutherland, who's a painter, who I saw a couple of weeks ago about doing a picture of Jack, but he said something to me so interesting. He said, the extraordinary thing about President Kennedy was that power made him a better man. And he said it made so many people worse men. He knew Winston Churchill well, he painted, and he said Winston, you know, became not less nice. And of course it made Adenauer meaner, and of course De Gaulle is the classic example. Well, it made Jack a chance to work for good, and I really think Harold Macmillan too.
Mm-hmm. You have any memory of the president's impression of people like Arthur Dean or McCloy or Foster in this connection with the test ban?
Not really.
This again was one of those prolonged things that kept dragging on for a long time.
I know, the discouragement, and then you just think of Arthur Dean. Remember, I used to feel sorry for him just sitting in Geneva all his life because I'd been in that depressing city. But no, you know, that's the kind of thing you wouldn't talk about at night. But I don't remember him hearing him say he was disappointed with anyone, or I remember him saying wonderful things about Harriman. That, you know.
Yes, when Harriman came in at the end, it was a... I think the Russians feel that when Harriman is sent to negotiate, the United States means business, and that was absolutely necessary to.
And it was very touching, Jack's relationship with Harriman, because of course he was, you know, there were all these young men around, and he was this man who went back so many administrations, but he just kept going up and up, didn't he, and getting to do more and more important things, and then Jack was so happy saying, for Averill. Well, he was so happy for Averill Harriman, really, after the test ban treaty.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, you know, that's really quite a crown.
Mm-hmm.
And there'd been something in Ted White's book, a little footnote about Averill Harriman, saying that he'd done all these extraordinary things in foreign policy, but that domestically, everything he'd done was disastrous. And I remember Jack feeling sort of sorry for him when he read that part of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And feeling so happy that this crowning blow, or this crowning thing came at the end for Averill Harriman. I gave him a copy of the test ban treaty, which the archives did specially for me. You can't tell it from the original when we left his house after. He lent it to us after November.
Oh, wonderful. It was in that winter in that fall and winter that Hickory Hill began. And in the winter of 62, there was a meeting at the White House, which David Donald, who was a professor at Princeton, spoke about the Civil War. I wasn't there, but the president mentioned it to me later. He apparently found it stimulating.
Yes, those seminars that Bobby did, well, Jack always wanted to go to them, but he just wanted to go to hear you. And when he'd heard that you'd finished Jackson and everything, and, you know, and it was an effort to go out, and he never... So finally, when he heard there was going to be an interesting one, which was the Civil War reconstruction thing, he said, let's have it at the White House. It was the first one. It was meant to have been at the Gilpatricks. And it was so strange, because I remember when the question period started, everyone was very quiet and rather nervous, you know, in the White House and the president there. And Jack asked Donald, do you think, it's the one thing that was on his mind, would Lincoln have been as great a president if he'd lived? And, I mean, would he be judged as great? Because he would have had this almost insoluble problem of the Reconstruction, which, you know, either way you did it would have dissatisfied so many people. He said that was his question. And Donald really, by going round and round, had agreed with him that Lincoln, was better for Lincoln's that he died when he did, and then I remember Jack saying, after the Cuban Missile Crisis, and it all turned so fantastically, he said, well, if anyone's ever going to shoot me, this would be the day they should do it.
Oh, really?
I mean, it's so strange these things that come back, because he saw then that he would be, you know, he said, we'll never top this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those things come back now.
Had that Lincoln question that he asked Donald, one that he'd discussed before,
oh, yes, on his because mind? All the time, we discussed it. So the first year I was married, I took a course in American history at the Georgetown School of Foreign Service from Professor Jules Davids, who was this brilliant man. And I'd never taken American history. And I used to come home full of these things. And I was so excited. And Thaddeus Stevens and the Radical Republicans, I can remember. And these awful poems they were writing about Lincoln. And Jack was excited that I was so interested. And then when he was doing Profiles in Courage, I told him how great Davids was, and he had him do some research on it. So, and he was, so at that time, we would talk a lot about Lincoln and the Reconstruction, and, you know, if he'd lived in that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was back in, what, 50, when we were married, it was 53, 54, and then his book was 54, 55.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked about it years before.
There was another Hickory Hill meeting at the White House, Isaiah Berlin.
Where they talked about Russia.
Yes.
Yeah, well, Jack loved that, and he loved to just listen to Isaiah Berlin. I mean, that was the side. You should read this article in Show magazine now, which I think is quite unfair in its judgment of Jack, but it puts him, it starts from the premise that Melbourne was his favorite book and says what he really was most like were these great Whig houses and Whig liberal families who, you know, had everything and
mm-hmm.
lived the stimulating life yet cared.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he loved all those brilliant English people. He used to tell me about going to Emerald Cunard's when he was a boy in London with his father. And to listen, and when we were in London together, we'd go to the old Duchess of Devonshire's for lunch, and she'd have a couple of people around. I mean, he loved so to hear those people talk. Or hear David, you know. They knew so much. Their educations were so incredible. That's when he was happiest.
Mm-hmm.
So he loved his Isaiah Berlin.
Do you want to say something about the relationship with David? Because I think that was a very fundamental thing in all this. I had the impression he talked with greater, more intimately with David than with any member of the of his own cabinet.
Except
Bobby.
Exactly. And if I could think of anyone now who could save the Western world, it would be David Gore.
Mm-hmm.
But they started as friends, obviously, in London. And Kathleen, who was Jack's favorite sister, was Sissy's best friend. And I guess David was the closest of all those friends then. I mean, so many of them ended up with rather sad lives or this or that.
This is back in 38,
39. Yeah. Hugh Fraser was sort of a friend, but not very bright. And you'd always wonder if Hugh would get a job in some government, and he never did, or it was a pathetic one. But whenever David was here, we'd see him, and Jack used to say that David Gore was the brightest man he'd ever met. He used to say that he and Bundy were, but he'd say that David more so than Bundy, because Bundy's intelligence is almost so, I can't describe it, so highly tuned that he couldn't often see, you know, the larger thing around him. I mean, David was more rooted and more compassionate. I can't describe it.
David has more wisdom, I think, than Mac is a brilliantly intelligent man. Yeah, but David's judgment is more.
And David has also the conciliatory sort of side that Jack did,
mm-hmm.
and not. You know, Bundy can get mad and then sort of arrogant and then make conciliation impossible. And Bundy in the missile crisis, when you think of that great mind, in the beginning he wanted to go in and bomb Cuba, and at the end he wanted to do nothing. So if he'd been relying on that great intelligence, look where we'd be.
How often would he see David?
Well, we'd see them a lot. We'd always see them. They would stay with us usually in vacations, or they'd come for a weekend to Camp David or the country or the Cape, or they'd come for dinner maybe once a month or so. You stopped asking them too much. We used to do it rather spontaneously, and of course they'd be involved in something official and then they'd get out of it. So I thought, I just can't do that to them. So we didn't see them as much as we would. You would have seen them every week if they hadn't been ambassador.
Killed the Alphonse as it was.
But, oh, and they'd always be talking on the phone. And, you know, so many times, get me the British ambassador, and David would tell you sometimes of the extraordinary places he'd been when he was ferreted out, mm-hmm. talked to Jack. And as I said, with David there, well, there was this one thing about British Guiana, which one night David really was worried about, and Jack said, well, what shall I do? And it was against rather our position, but David said, you should call Utant and tell him whatever it was. So anyway, Jack did that, and it was everything, you know, worked out well. And then the Skybolt thing. After Nassau, David came back to Florida with us. And of course, the next day, the whole thing blew up.
Mm-hmm.
Godfrey McHugh came tearing in saying, have you heard the wonderful news, Mr. President? They've just shot off Skybolt and it worked or something. And Jack said, what? God damn you, Godfrey, get out of here. And so anyway, he and David sat there and everything was so awful, and they called Gilpatrick, and McNamara was away, and then David went into another room and called Hal McMillan. And, but you know, that closeness kept, well, I mean, everything could have blown apart mm-hmm. between England and America then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was just a terribly, and of all Jack's friends now, David Gore's the one, I'd say next to Bobby and me, he's the one who's been the most wounded. Perhaps that's not fair, but he's the friend that I'll always see for the rest of my life. So many of the others I can't bear to see because I miss Jack's lacking.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Bartletts, the Bradleys, the people you saw like that. Anyway.
Oh, David is one of the... sort of intellectually and emotionally, he's a rich person. And a generous one, and
and he's not ambitious. I always kept hoping he'd give up his title and be prime minister one day, but I think he'll be foreign secretary. He's not, he doesn't have this drive that Jack did, but he still cares. I suppose he can do as much that way.
No, I've been after him too, to try to get him to give up his title, but it's clear that he's probably not going to do it.
And it isn't because he cares that much about his title. It's just that he's never been pushy.
That's right. He thinks if he does this, it will signal the fact that he wants to be prime minister, which he thinks is an absurd thing for him to want to be. Well, of course it isn't. In the winter or in early spring of 63, one big thing, of course, was the steel crisis. And were you were around that?
And I remember how, well, really outraged Jack was. You know, which one of the few times he really controlled his temper. I mean, never saw him lose it, but just sometimes that flash. I mean, he was really, what Roger Blau did to him.
Mm-hmm. He felt that Roger Blau had double-crossed him in a
way. Yes, and it was, you know, I just remember the expression, his mouth was really tight, and you just didn't do that. You just didn't behave that way. I suppose Bobby said to me later that if we'd known people like Andre Meyer or something, or had more friends in that community, perhaps it could have all been arranged with less bitterness.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, then I can remember that it was back and forth between his office and the White House and calling everyone, and getting Clark Clifford was the one person they found who they thought the others would trust, and sending him up to negotiate and which person would back out. It was the man, I met him the other day.
From Chicago.
Is it Lackland or whichever the company first broke, and he was at the library dinner with Jack. And then I also remember Bobby saying to me later, this was in November, That remember how it said in the press that the FBI got sent into everybody's home at night or something, mm-hmm. or reporters?
Woke up reporters at 2 in the morning.
Well, Bobby was talking something about how awful J. Edgar Hoover's been since Jack died, and, you know, the way he curries favor with Lyndon Johnson by sending in all these awful reports about everyone. But Bobby said that he'd always, you know, tried to deal so nicely with Hoover, and whenever anything the FBI ever did well, it was fine with him if Hoover took credit for it, and anything the FBI ever did badly, you know, Bobby would take credit for it. And that was all the FBI, not Bobby, who sent those people in, you know, to, which was what really caused an awful lot of the bitterness against Jack, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah.
I mean, I can't remember who they wrote up or what reporter they would be waking up right now, but I remember Jack being upset at that.
Mm-hmm. Arthur Goldberg was played an active role in this Steele thing, and Ted Sorensen, I imagine. But the president was really...
It seems to me mostly Jack on the phone and Clifford, but yeah. I suppose all the rest went on in the office. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that he was madder over this than anything else on any other occasion in the administration?
I think just after Roger Blau came in his office and told him that, mm-hmm. you know, a flare. And as I say, the second closest thing I've seen to it is sometimes after the Germans had done one more damn irritating but relatively minor mm-hmm. thing. You know, but yes, I would say the Steele thing. And then it changed from madness. I mean, all the time he was acting in the crisis, he wasn't acting out of madness and temper. Then it was just trying to see how you could, you know, then he was working it like a chessboard or this mm-hmm. or that. Mm-hmm. But that first, I guess you just don't do that.
How about Governor Barnett in Mississippi? Was he mad then? I suppose he was less... He felt betrayed by Blau. He had no reason, I guess, to expect Barnett to act differently from the way he did.
Well, you see, Barnett, it was just so hopeless. And you knew the man was an inferior Welshing person to begin with. There was never rage there. It was a... Oh, I don't know, just hopeless. And you know what I can remember? I was in Newport. In bed, and he called me. It was that night, and at 5 o'clock in the morning, the phone rang. And I guess he'd just gone back to the White House after staying up all night. And you know, I was so touched that he called me because he just wanted to talk. And he said, "Oh my God, you wouldn't realize what it had been like." And I guess when, you know, the tear gas started to run out, and the troops that were meant to get there in an hour. We're still 4 hours away, and I guess that was just one of the worst nights of his whole life.
Was the civil rights thing something he talked much about?
You know, it was over such a long period of time, and there were always all the Barnetts and then the Wallaces and then, one sort of awful problem after another. And first thinking of that Little Rock had been so badly handled, I guess he thought. And then you see him presented with an almost worse Little Rock at Oxford. And, and then with, you know, obviously.
What did he think of the Negro leaders, Martin Luther King, for example? Did he ever mention?
Well, I do know what he thought of him later. Well, he said what an incredible speaker he was during that Freedom March thing, and, you know, and he acknowledged that having made that call during the campaign got them. Then he told me of a tape that the FBI had of Martin Luther King when he was here for the Freedom March. And he said this with no bitterness or anything. How he was calling up all these girls and arranging for a party of men and women. I mean, sort of an orgy in the hotel and everything.
Martin Luther King?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But first he said, oh, you know, and I said, oh, but Jack, that's so terrible. I mean, that man is, such a phony then. No, this was when there was just one girl. They had the conversation. And Jack said, oh, well, you know, he would never judge anyone in any sort of way. Oh, well, you know. He never really said anything against Martin Luther King. Since then, Bobby's told me of the tapes of these orgies they have and had Martin Luther King made fun of Jack's funeral.
Oh, no.
And made fun of Cardinal Cushing and said that he was drunk at it. And things about they almost dropped the coffin. Well, I mean, that Martin Luther King is really a tricky person.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't know. He never said anything against Martin Luther King to me. So, I don't know if Bobby would be the one to find out what he ever really thought of
mm-hmm.
in that way. But Bobby told me later, I just can't see a picture of Martin Luther King without thinking, you know, that man's terrible.
Mm-hmm.
I know at the time of the Freedom March, when they all came in his office, well, I think he was touched by Philip Randolph.
Mm-hmm. Philip Randolph's very impressive. He's an older man, has great dignity.
Yeah. And all that, and he was very worried about that Freedom March. Turned out all right, I guess.
Worried that it might lead to violence?
Well, yes, everyone was worried, weren't they?
Mm-hmm.
And, but, you know, civil rights just, well, that was just something that was always there, wasn't it? And then I remember he got mad at, when we were in Texas, in November. He was mad to me about Lyndon because he said Lyndon's trying so hard to show everyone that he's a real liberal, that he'd done something down there and made some speech which had just caused infinitely more trouble. Whereas if he got all the South mad or something, mm-hmm. then Lyndon was trying to make the, I don't know who like in the Northern liberals, I guess. He said if he just had, tried so hard to do what was best for Lyndon Johnson, I mean, this whole problem would have been made so much easier. But I forget exactly what speech that was. You could find that out.
The, one of the other things in the autumn of 1962, of course, there's the political campaign. And there was also the biggest thing was the Cuban Missile Crisis. How early were you told about the missiles?
I can't remember if people knew about missiles when Jack went away on that speaking trip, did they?
They did, yeah.
Everybody knew?
No.
Just a few special people?
Yeah.
Was it ever in the papers then?
It was not in the papers. He went over, the news arrived on a Tuesday. And then a small, very small group knew. And he went away, you remember, on the Thursday or Friday, on the Friday, and then came back on the Saturday, and then gave his speech on the Monday following.
Well, I can't remember if I knew before, or if I, I'm sure I would have known if he was worried or something, but I can remember so well. I'd just gotten down to Glenora with the children. And it was a Friday afternoon or a Saturday afternoon?
Saturday afternoon.
Whenever he made up his mind to come back.
Saturday afternoon.
And you just sort of gotten there, and I was lying in the sun, and it was so nice to be there, and this call came through from Jack. And he said, I'm coming back to Washington this afternoon. Why don't you come back there? And there were, you know, usually he would be coming down, or I thought he'd be away for the weekend, or he would be coming down on a Saturday, or I would have said, well, why don't you come down here or something? But there was just something funny in his voice, and he never asked me to do, I mean, he knew that those weekends and away from the tension of the White House were so good for me, and, you know, he'd encourage you to do it, and it was just so unlike him. Having known you'd just gotten down there with two rather whiny children who you'd have to wake up from their naps and get back. But I could tell from his voice something was wrong, so I didn't even ask. I said, sort of, why? And he said, well, never mind. Why don't you just come back to Washington? So, you woke them up from their naps and we got back there. Mm-hmm. I suppose around 6 or something. And then I guess he told me. I think that must have been when. But I just knew whenever he asks, or I thought whenever you're married to someone and they ask something, you know, that's the whole point of being married. You just sense the trouble in their voice and mustn't ask why. And so he came right back. And then those days were, well, I forget how many they were. Were they 11, 10, something? But from then on, it seemed there was no waking or sleeping. And I just don't know which day was which. But I know that Jack, he said something. I know he told me right away. And some people had said for their wives to go away. And Mrs. Phyllis Dillon told me later that Douglas had taken her for a walk and told her what was happening and suggested she go to Hope Sound or somewhere. I don't know if she did or not. And I remember saying, well, I knew if anything happened, we'd all be evacuated to Camp David or something. And I don't know if he said anything about that to me. I don't think but I said, please don't send me away to Camp David, you know, me and the children. Please don't send me anywhere. If anything happens, we're all going to stay right here with you. And, you know, and I said, even if there's not room in the bomb shelter in the White House, which I'd seen, I said, please, then I just want to be on the lawn when it happens. You know, but I just want to be with you, and I want to die with you, and the children do too, and live without you. So he said he wouldn't send me away. I mean, he didn't really want to send me away either.
What was his mood when he told you?
Well, it wasn't... You know, it wasn't exactly sort of sit down, I have something to tell you. It was so much going on, and then as the time went on, it turned out, well, you know, the awful fluke of a couple of days, like one day they took pictures and there was nothing there, then the next day was foggy, and then McCone had just gotten married again and had gone off on a honeymoon. Well, now that was one of the real problems, and he'd stopped. Or there was something rather tricky there, that him being out of town on his honeymoon didn't order another flight or didn't something, so you would have known a couple of days sooner. There's something there where McCone, who was, I don't know whether to blame McCone. I mean, he could have postponed his honeymoon a bit, or whether it was just a helpless accident, but that was responsible for a delay. And then when those pictures came through and they knew them, well, then, as I say, there was no day or night, because I can remember one night Jack was lying on his bed in his room, and it was really late, and I came in my nightgown. I thought he was talking on the phone. I'd been in and out of there all evening. And suddenly he saw him waving me away, get out, get out. I'd already run over to his bed, and it was because Bundy was in the room. And poor Puritan Bundy, to see a woman running in her nightgown, he threw both hands over his eyes, and he was talking on another phone to someone. Well, then I got out of the room and waited for Jack in my room. And whether he came to bed at 2, 3, 4, I don't know. And then another night, I remember Bundy at the foot of both our beds, you know, waking Jack up for something, and Jack would go into his own room and then talk on the phone maybe till, say, from 5 to 6 to 7, and then he might come back and sleep for 2 hours and go to his office. Or, as I say, there was no day or night. And, well, that's the time I've been the closest to him. And I never left the house or saw the children, and when he came home, if it was for sleep or for a nap, I would sleep with him. And I'd walk by his office all the time, and sometimes he would take me out. It was funny, for a walk around the lawn a couple of times. We didn't very often do that. We'd just sort of walk quietly, then go back in. It was just this vigil. And then I remember another morning, must have been a weekend morning, when there was a meeting in the Oval Room, and everybody come in one car so that the press wouldn't get suspicious, and Bobby came in a convertible and riding clothes. And I was there, so... And then I went in the treaty room, where I just to fiddle through some mail or something, but I could hear them talking through the door. And I went up and listened and eavesdropped. And I guess that was at a rather vital time, because I could hear McNamara saying something. I think we should do this, that, this, that. No, McNamara summing up something, and then Gilpatrick giving some summary. And then a lot of questions. And then I thought, well, I mustn't listen. And I went away.
The president comment at all on the question of whether there should be a raid to knock the bases out or blockade or what? I mean, you mentioned Mac Bundy's.
Well, that I all knew later, and that was never told to me till much, much later.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing was, it was just so, he really wasn't sort of asking me, but... Then I remember he did tell me about this crazy telegram that came through from Khrushchev one night. Very warlike. I guess he'd sent the nice one first, where he looked like he would, Khrushchev had, where he might dismantle him. And then this crazy one came through in the middle of the night. Well, I remember Jack being really upset about that and telling me. And then deciding that they would just answer the first.
Mm-hmm.
Being in on that. I also remember him telling me about Gromyko, which was very early in it.
Oh, yes.
How he'd seen Gromyko and he talked to him and everything they'd said, and that he really wanted to put Gromyko on the line of just lying to him and never giving anything away. And I said, how could you keep a straight face? Or how could you not say, you rat, sitting there? And he said, what, and tip our whole hand? So he just